The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
My husband and I listen to your show all the time, and we just love it.
Love your show.
I think you're a wonderful combination of information, humor, and faith. I just really appreciate you being on the air.
It's a beautiful day.
This is my third trip to the Indo-Pacific region as vice president. Between the United States and our allies and partners in this region. The discussions that we had included, in large part, a discussion about the significance of the climate crisis and what we can do as the United States to be a leader in that regard.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Great to have you here today. It's Monday after a busy, busy weekend at Stately Stegall Manor. I spent most of the weekend decking the halls, ladies and gentlemen. I was out of doors almost all week long, all weekend long, making the appropriate accommodations for the exterior of Stately Stegall Manor, decking the halls with Christmas cheer. I paid scant little attention to any of this stuff until late last night while... Well, I was watching that outstanding come-from-behind Eagles game, and I thought to myself, are we actually going to lose to the Colts? Because I watched my Chiefs lose to the Colts earlier this year, and I thought, is this stupid team going to defeat the Eagles, too? Eagles fixed it, came from behind, got her done, very satisfying, and then finished decking the halls last night and got inside just in time to watch some late Sunday night football and a Chiefs come-from-behind win in Los Angeles. I'm just feeling great today, full of Christmas cheer. Two victorious football teams yesterday. Nothing's wrong with the world. Ain't nothing going to, and it's Thanksgiving week, folks. Ain't nothing going to break my stride today. No, sir. Not even the new triple-demic. Did you hear about this? I tweeted about it yesterday. I'm listening to, I've got it rigged up in the garage at Stately Stegall Manor so that I can listen. Sort of listen slash watch football while working out of doors. Kind of man cave-ish, if you will. And so I can keep one ear on TV while I'm doing other things. And I'm just happen to be enjoying a fragrant aromatic cigar as I'm standing there watching. I'm taking a quick break, enjoying a cigar, watching the TV. And the local anchor at halftime says, tonight... What your kids need to know to stay safe from the triple-demic. Actual word uttered by an actual news anchor. Triple-demic. Have you heard this one used yet, Fast Eddie?
Oh, yes, because I take my kid to CHOP, so we've heard all about the triple-demic.
Have you used, has that word been used before in your presence?
It has, yes, actually.
I have never heard this word triple-demic until yesterday. I didn't know that was a thing. Triple demic. Okay, so since you know, then you tell me, what the hell is that?
All right, so we are, it's scary actually, we're looking at a mix of RSV, flu, and COVID. That's the triple demic.
Okay. Two of those things you know have always existed.
Yes.
Would that have been a double demic?
Pre-COVID-19, no.
Okay. So, I hope your son doesn't get this, heaven forbid, but your son was always vulnerable to a double-demic.
Mm-hmm.
Does triple-demic scare you?
Honestly, this RSV thing as a parent, yes, it does scare me, but he's had COVID. You know what I mean? I believe he's had the flu, to be perfectly honest.
But RSV is also always a thing. It's always been a thing. Kids get RSV. Like, it's been around. It's not, that's not new, right?
Yeah, correct.
I mean, you don't. No one wants their kid to get sick. I understand that. No one wants their baby to get sick. Babies are vulnerable people. They're little, and you know, so their strength is not as great to overcome certain things. I get it. I'm not downplaying. It just, this is the kind of thing, folks, that just irks me. It's designed for neurotics. It's designed for people who are already on a knife's edge about life in general. Tripledemic. That is a completely made up word. Wholly made up. There's no such thing. What the hell is that? The flu is always a thing. RSV has always been a thing. COVID has always been a thing. And what do we know about COVID and kids? It almost never turns into something serious for kids. COVID of the three is not a threat. Of the three to your child, COVID's not a threat. Have we all established that by now? I should hope after 3 years we've established that. So if you take COVID away as a threat, because I think we all agree it's not a threat to children, it is not a tripledemic. So it's not even triply scary. Now we're talking about double scary. And the two things that are doubly scary have always been things. I resent this stuff. I'm sorry, folks. It irks me. And on the same day that I get this news, a new scientific study claims to have found little to no health risks related to eating red meat. We'll find in time that everything you're told to be scared of was for naught. And such is the case with this story. The study says previous studies claiming there was a, I love the study now studies the studies, that says the previous studies. And you can file tripledemic in the same study one of these days. They'll study the study of the pandemic, tripledemic study. A link between red meat consumption and health issues based on weak evidence. Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation released a study titled Health Effects Associated with Consumption of Unprocessed Red Meat, a Burden of Proof Study. The paper was published in the Nature of Journal in October, and the scientists declared, quote, we found weak evidence of association between unprocessed red meat consumption and colorectal cancer, breast cancer, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. Moreover, we found no evidence of an association between unprocessed red meat, stroke, either kinds of strokes, neither of which type of stroke I can pronounce, so I'm not going to try. The authors of the study noted while there is some evidence that eating unprocessed red meat is associated with increased risk of incidence and mortality, it is weak and insufficient to make stronger or more conclusive recommendations. Blah, blah, blah. Now, in the era of being told that meat is evil and that you should be afraid of the tripledemic, you know what makes me mad is conversations like I had with Naomi Wolf, Dr. Naomi Wolf, and that I've had with Alex Berenson. And countless other numbers of health professionals or doctors or just critics or journalists who've come on this show. And I have literally been banned on YouTube for having interviews and conversations about what this shot might do to your system. No curiosity whatsoever. I'm going to tell you something, and I debate telling you this because it's a little personal, but and I didn't ask permission. Well, you know what? I'm not going to identify who it is. Uh-oh. Never mind. I'll just say this. Someone that I know that's close to me is a shot acolyte. I mean, worships at the altar of shots. And I'm half irritated at this person, so I've got to watch myself. This person's a occasional listener. So I was about to tell you who, and then I decided I thought better of it, just in case there's an uncomfortable conversation later. This shot acolyte, who's worshipped at the altar of this shot from the very beginning, raced to get the first one, and got sick. Raced to get the second one, and got sick. Raced to get the booster and got sick. Texts me yesterday after I haven't heard from this person for several days. Can you guess? There's a running theme in this story. Haven't heard from this person in several days. And this person says to me over text, Sorry, been out of commission. Got a little under the weather. Want to guess why?
COVID?
No, got another damn booster.
Oh, no.
I'm not making it up. Fourth COVID shot, sick a fourth time, and says to me, I kid you not, I nearly came out of my skin when I got this text yesterday. This person says to me, sorry, been a little out of commission lately, feeling a little under the weather, starting to rebound, got my COVID booster, my fourth COVID booster, but I guess it's better than having COVID, says this person to me. This isn't long after I heard the news anchor say triple-demic. And I just felt like, I felt insane. I felt like I lived in a crazy world where people are worrying about things that aren't real and completely ignoring things that are real. I feel insane. When it comes to matters of health, and I am not the pinnacle of health, folks, I realize that. I'm not a doctor. I'm nobody that should stand on the sidelines and talk to people or lecture to people about their health. But I am a guy who just uses common sense. And I just think to myself, people will get themselves wrapped around the axle about news anchors and triple-demics, and they'll run out and they'll inject themselves with every pharmaceutical known to man. But without questioning at once, will they ever ask, do I need this? Is this necessary? Does this make things worse? What are the side effects of that? Just give me pharmaceuticals. Give me. No curiosity. If a lab coat says it, if a news anchor says it, if a pharmaceutical sales rep says it, oh, just inject it in me, stick it in me, give it to me. Triple-demic. And the thing is, I can hardly blame some people because their reasoning skills leave them when they become neurotic about their health. And what is that rooted in, mostly? I mean, if I could just be completely blunt, can I just... I'm going to get myself in trouble here on a short week and Thanksgiving week, no less. I think it's a lot of people who are just absolutely full of terror about staying alive. Like, the worst case scenario in the world is death itself. And I've thought a lot about this. I don't want to die prematurely. I'd like to live a long, healthy life. We all would. But you know something? More than ever before in my life, I am more at peace and ready about my eternal reward and where I'm headed than I've ever been in my life. And so if a car strikes me dead this afternoon, or if some disease knocks me out, I don't want that. I think that's sad. I think that's sad for my family. I of course, nobody wants that. But I'm not, listen to me, I'm not going to lead my life constantly, every single day, in gripping terror of what might take me from this earth. I don't control it, and neither do you. And really manipulative, slimy people spend their lives and livelihoods lying to you about things, scaring you about things, telling you got to inject yourself with this, triple-demic that, don't eat that. And you'll do it. You'll do it because I don't want to get sick and die. I don't want my kid to get sick and die. I'm elderly. I don't want to get sick and die. There's reasonable, and then there's just incurious. There's reasonable, then there's unreasonable. There's reasonable, then there's just panicking and not using logic. There's reasonable, and then there's being manipulated out of your fear. And there are too many people in our midst that are just walking around in a perpetual state of fear. Afraid of their own shadow, afraid of catching something, afraid of their loved ones catching something. We're in a perpetual state of, oh, look out! Folks, I can't live that way. There's reasonable, and then there's irrational. Triple-demic is irrational. Not eating meat was always irrational. Always. It never made sense. blindly injecting yourself with a pharmaceutical product that's brand new and shows no evidence of working. In fact, in many studies, shows evidence of doing the opposite, hurting you. Makes no sense. Triple-demic doesn't make any sense. The flu has always been a thing. RSV has always been a thing. I told you 2 years ago when little kids weren't socializing that kids were catching. I talked with one of my friends at a children's hospital. I said, what's going on with kids and COVID? They said, it's really not COVID. It's upper respiratory infections. It's RSV. We knew about this 2 years ago when we weren't socializing kids at all. The uptick in this stuff is because we had quarantined and locked away our children and kept them from one another. That's why these things flare up. I don't know. Then I got this story in front of me. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Does this come as a shock? Because again, panic! Panic! People will do whatever they're told because panic, right? So one of the things that a lot of government agencies told us to do during COVID was, hey, download this helpful app to tell you who's sick around you so you don't get sick. Ooh, yes, government, I'll do it. I'll do whatever you tell me because I'm scared of getting sick. What do I download on my phone? I don't want to get sick. I'm scared of everyone else getting sick. I'm scared of everyone around me giving me something that'll make me sick. What do I need to do, government? Tell me. Well, inject this and download this on your phone. Okay, I'll do it. I'll blindly do it. Whatever you tell me, I'm scared of getting sick, and I don't want my loved ones getting sick. Neurotic crazies. And so does it surprise you then? The Massachusetts Department of Public Health is facing a class action lawsuit for working with Google to install spyware on Android devices of 1 million Massachusetts residents without their knowledge during COVID. So the state of Massachusetts and Google installed spyware on citizens' phones by the millions. Plaintiffs Robert Wright and Johnny Kula were among 1 million Massachusetts residents who installed the state's COVID exposure settings app on their phone. The app installed without their consent, says the New Civil Liberties Alliance. The app, once automatically installed, how does an app install without your, I don't know, well, whatever. Anyway, it didn't appear on the device's home screen as newly installed apps typically do. Instead, it was invisible and could be found only by opening settings and using the View All Apps feature. This meant that many device users were unaware of its presence. Many have decried this as an invasion of privacy. Well, of course it is. The Android attack deliberately designed to override the constitutional and legal rights of citizens to be free from government intrusions. Now, I don't understand how this secretly installs. Other states and foreign countries mostly tried to persuade citizens to voluntarily install contact tracing apps. I always hated that term, contact tracing. I remember when we were throwing that around a lot. In fact, I remember when there was discussion of government volunteers becoming contact tracers. I think we paid people to do that, didn't we, Fast Eddie? Is my memory escaping me?
Yeah, his Wolf's first acronym was the CCCP. Remember, it was the Coronavirus Civilian Contact Tracing Corps or whatever.
That's right! Herr Wolf hired a bunch of coronavirus brown shirts to run around the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Yep. And are you feeling ill? Check. You are quarantined. You are tagged like a deer. They would, I don't know what they were doing with people. Were they tagging us, installing apps? I don't even remember what they were doing exactly. How long that lasted. Whatever happened to that? The Coronavirus Civil Protection Force or whatever the hell.
I'll have to look it up, but I remember it was, and also Levine. Remember she, Dr. Levine was out there saying, you know, wash your hands, stay 6 feet apart. Oh, and also download this app, the COVID app.
Yeah, download the app. Well, guess what? A bunch of people are shocked to find that the app was secretly surveilling them. That's what I mean, folks. I get so exacerbated. I was in a really good mood. Like I said, I'm not anything but happy today, believe it or not. I just can't stand when neurotic people are manipulated and then later they find out, oh, I guess I was manipulated. Yes. And people like me, while you were being manipulated, said, you're being manipulated. And you shouted, shut up, I'm trying to be healthy and keep people well and alive. Okay, I think you ought to calm down and consider what you're being told. No! You're irresponsible! Put on a mask, shoot that in your system, download the app, and shut up! Okay, but your constant perpetual fear may cause you to compromise some of your civil liberties in the future. Shut up, you! It's always hard for me to do these rearview mirror stories 2 and 3 years later when I know when it was hard, during the time it was hard and everybody else was in a panic. And I said, can we pump the brakes for a second? And I got the receipts, by the way. I got all the shows to prove I said it. This stuff was hyperbole at the time. And now with some time and distance from it, all of it, any of it. It's and I hate it. Believe me, it brings me no joy that we now have to look at suspicion, everything that comes from government health agencies. That's one of those things that you wished you could trust. You wished that government agents stepping forward and saying to the nation, here's a health concern that we all need to be mindful of. I wish now that I didn't have to think twice about even them, but we do. Triple demic. Everybody is on. I'll just tell you, if you people that are on edge about your health and are constantly worried about trying to stay alive and are afraid of your shadow killing you, then you probably should or shouldn't. I don't know how you want to look at it. Dr. Naomi Wolf and my conversation with her at the Harumph Society. I guess you should, particularly if you're a woman in this audience. I'll just tell you this. If you're a woman of a reproductive age, all right, if you have or are planning to conceive children, well, I shouldn't say have. That doesn't apply to anybody who has. But if you are actively considering conceiving a child, or you may in the future, it depends on your neuroses, I suppose. You should or you should not listen to Dr. Naomi Wolf's conversation with me at the Harumph Society a couple of weeks ago. Because it depends. Like, if you're constantly terrified of your shadow, you need to hear it. If you've already had the shot out of fear from your shadow, then maybe you shouldn't. Because she's more aggressive on this than I am. I'm like, hey, look, if you're an adult, you do you. She thinks people should be locked away for war crimes over the shot, all right? Like, she thinks we're immediately engaged in criminal behavior injecting people with this thing. I don't go that far because I feel like you're an adult. It's on the market. You do you. I mean, there's a lot out there you can put in your system that I wouldn't recommend. That now people are making perfectly legal and accessible. So, well, all right, neither here nor there. One other thing. I'm not hearing a lot about this shooting at the gay nightclub in Colorado Springs, except that there was one. And I kept noticing throughout the day yesterday and into this morning, and in fact, until I got in here and just started reading about it, I always, whenever I hear about a shooting, I'm always quick to try to find out who it was that did it. The media is never quick to want to know who did it. You ever notice that? Media never wants to tell you who did it if they can't immediately tie it to something that's a storyline they desperately want to use for politics. Do you know how I know every... Here's the tell. I think going forward, you should know this about any, you know, God forbid, mass shooting event in the future. You should always know that when there's a mass shooting event and they don't talk about the shooter, That means there's something about the shooter that would unravel all the politics that they're trying to inject in the story. Follow? So every time there's a, follow me here. Every time there's a mass shooting, if the news is focused only on the victims and not who did the shooting, that's the tell. If you're only focused on the victims and not who did the shooting, that's the tell. What do you mean, Stigall? Yet again, there aren't many sources telling you this. What do you know about this shooting if, in fact, you're following the news? You know it was a gay nightclub. And that means what? Gays had to be targeted. Well, it's funny. I started to hear that yesterday, that gays were the target and this kind of hate crime and homophobia, this is the problem with the country today. And I thought, okay, I'll dig into that later. I heard that in passing before church yesterday. By middle of the day, toward the evening last night, I started to hear this, and I heard it again this morning. This marks yet another, in fact, even during Sunday Night Football, Chris Collinsworth and Mike Tirico commenting on the shocking rise of gun violence in this country. We just got to do something. It's just a crazy world out there, all these shootings. They were likening it to the kid who shot the three University of Virginia football players. As though they're related at all. As though, I mean, again, I'm not all terrible, stipulated. But a gay nightclub Colorado Springs shooting and the thug who shot three football players point blank on a Sunday night at the University of Virginia, they're not related in any way. There's no bad people do bad things, just like the four kids murdered in Idaho are not related to the awful people do awful things. There is evil. Satan is real. He is at work, and awful people do horribly awful things. They're not related, and I resist. Here's another thing. I resist and reject and resent when people go, what is it going with this crazy world today? We got to do something about the guns. Immediately, people jump to the gun. It's irrational, much like the shot talk. It's irrational. And so news started out by telling me, hate crime, isn't this terrible? The gays were targeted. That went away, and I thought, there's a reason that went away, and we've shifted to gun violence. And aha, here's the reason. I finally found it. See, stick with me, because this is, again, not something you'd notice if you were consuming regular mainstream news. The 22-year-old that suspected an opening fire at the gay nightclub was charged with felony menacing in the summer of 2021. He's a kook. He's a lunatic. The suspect's mother told police that in June of last year, her son was threatening to cause harm to her with a homemade bomb, multiple weapons, and ammunition. Police learned that the suspect was in a home near his mother's residence and went to speak with him. He initially refused to interact with the police before eventually coming out to surrender. He was charged with 2 counts of felony menacing, 3 counts of first-degree kidnapping for the incident. No explosives were found during the search of his home. The guy's a kook. Sick people, evil people, do kooky, evil things. And yet again, kooky evil has crossed paths with law enforcement and has been set free to roam. So, and I don't know what we'll find out about this guy. It wouldn't surprise me if we find out that he knew something about the gay nightclub or was a frequent guest there, or who knows. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't know. I don't want to speculate. But my point is, this was originally hate crime. We have no evidence that this is a hate crime. Remember when the guy ran around and he was shooting up Asian massage parlors and everybody said, Asian hate. No, it turned out he was a pervert who was going to these places for a little rub and tug. And he was trying to get his mind right about it, and so he decided in his lunatic mind the best way to deal with it was to assassinate everybody that was giving him a hand at the massage parlors. He's a kook. He wasn't targeting Asians. He was targeting people that were illegally sexually pleasing him for money. He was a kook. And I'll bet we'll find, I don't know for a fact, but I'll bet we'll find that this kook who law enforcement knew was a kook probably wasn't as much anti-gay as he was just a kook. I resent people preying on the fears of the American public that's too naive to do the deep dive themselves, to do the research and the work themselves. And increasingly, that's more and more of us. Not you. You're the smartest audience going. So I know I don't have to tell this to you, but so many of our friends and neighbors just lap this stuff up. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. Let's go to Jason to kick things off today. Thanksgiving week, Jason. You're the first caller to kick off the week, so no pressure, but make it good. Good morning.
Hey, Chris. Good morning. Thanks for being the voice of reason to our city and surrounding communities. Yeah, it is a kick of turkey week. I'm delivering turkeys right now, actually. But no, you just struck a chord with.
Are you really? Whoa! Hang on. Yeah. I don't want to blow past that. Hang on, just a second. Where are you delivering turkeys?
I have a half a trailer load going to the farmer's market in Medford, and then a second half is going to the farmer's market in Westchester.
That's fantastic. So you raise them.
I work for the farmers that do. Yes, I'm in the trucking business.
Oh, my gosh. Now, can you tell me, just because I'm interested, I've got plenty of time, so I'm not going to rush you through this call. I'm just interested. What do you know about availability and prices and whatnot this year for turkeys? Because that was another thing that a lot of people were hysterical about.
Yeah, so availability, we've been able to fulfill all our orders, but pricing is up on average 40%.
Oh, okay.
So that's
and what causes that?
Primarily feed and the cost of raising, but also transportation is a huge factor. You know, fuel, I just bought fuel this morning at $5.78 a gallon. Mm. So that means my operating cost for fuel alone is over $1 a gallon to run my truck. Or excuse me, $1 a mile. That's just so, in fuel expenses.
Yeah, so unquestionably, inflation, what we're living through, this 40-year high inflation, that is walloping your delivery prices as well as the costs of raising, processing, sending these birds to market. No doubt about it.
Absolutely. In fact, this year, my fuel surcharge almost mirrors the line haul. So if it costs $1,000 to get the birds to the market, as far as a line haul charge, there's almost another $1,000 fuel surcharge.
Wow.
On top of that.
Wow. Thank you for that. I just always like to learn from real-world experience, people out there actually doing it. So when people say, I can't believe how expensive turkey is, you've given us a real-world lesson as to why. So thank you for that, Jason. Now, the reason for your call, please continue.
Yeah, no, you just struck a chord with the tridemic or whatever they're calling it, and then also the fear of death. And for the most part, my family, I've chosen not to participate in a plandemic, scamdemic, but inevitably it affects all of us, right? So I've had the opportunity to have these conversations with different people about the fear that's surrounding everything that's going on. And as a Christian, you know, it's very clear to us in the Bible that we're not to fear death. It actually says to die is to gain, and to be absent from the body is present with the Lord. So I just rest in that, and that's what I hear you saying. You don't fear death. It's not necessarily you look forward to it, but you're looking for that eternal reward, I heard you say this morning. And there's been a couple of times that I've had that conversation with other church-going people or professing Christians, and it's clicked. And I've just seen physically that fear just come away from their face, and they look at it with a different perspective. So I appreciate you bringing it up.
Jason, I thank you for saying so. I'm not qualified to minister, but I will tell you this. If it were up to me, I would tell every professing Christian and everybody who attends regular worship, why are you so scared? I agree with you. When you actually challenge someone
exactly.
who is a believer, people who are believers, and I'm not talking about people who don't really believe or people who are suspicious or people who don't attend or worship or, you know, whatever. But for people who are active participants in their worship services and are believers, you want to grab them by the shoulders sometimes and go, why are you behaving this way? Is this what you believe in?
Exactly.
This is why I don't drink anymore. You know, I drank and drank and drank a lot for a long time, and I did it to suppress a lot of stuff that gave me anxiety or stress or whatever. And I tell people this when they're this, you're not asking, but I'm telling you this as an example. I stopped because as a Christian, as a professing Christian, I kept thinking to myself, what am I telling the world? What am I telling friends? What am I telling my family? Every time I get upset, tense, stressed, whatever, I got to get drunk. And I thought that is the worst representation of what I believe. So similarly, it's that my point in bringing that up is living with this contagious fear. Not that we shouldn't get medicine and seek medical treatment and try to stay healthy. And everybody wants to lead a long, healthy life. I'm not saying disregard science, but living in perpetual being motivated by fear is not the way of a Christian's walk. Right?
It's not. That's correct. And I don't want to be offensive or antagonistic, but I've taken the opportunity to speak to people that I know that go to church about this subject. And I'll just say, I'd really challenge you about what you're taking in, even at church, because if this is new news to you, you might want to go to a different church.
Amen.
And and a couple of times I've had the opportunity to do that, it's been received, so I'm thankful for that.
Oh, Jason, I pray that everybody who is a believer is having the same kind of clarity that you're having. And I ended up leaving my church over the same issue. When fear becomes the model, when, for instance, my church closed for over a year, it made me sick. And I begged and pled with church leadership, we can't keep doing this. And they kept deferring to county health officials. And they were so terrified of their own shadows. And I just said, this is antithetical to what we believe. And they didn't see it that way. And I knew it was time to find a new church home.
Yeah. And that's, I'm glad you took that step, and you'll be blessed by it. You know, the Bible also talks about a veil over your eyes being thick, and I think that veil is so thick, but truth can pierce it, and I hear you speaking truth, so I so appreciate it.
Jason, thank you, my friend. I really appreciate you calling and saying so. That made my week. Boy, he put up or there, when you say put up or shut up, Jason brought it right out of the gate today. Thank you. And not just because he was complimenting me, though that's a fine start. Thank you, Jason. Telephone number 610-850-0990. Yeah, we've got time for one more. Let's squeeze one more in here. Kat and Glenn Olden. Hey, Kat, I'm glad you called. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. I met you at the Fuse, the Talkers, with Sebastian.
What a night.
First time. Yes, it was a great night, but first time I'm calling the show. I listen every morning.
You
are so on target with this whole COVID BS. I'm a dental hygienist, and I am still, almost 3 years dealing with patients coming in chronically that are sick over and over again. They'll come in and they'll say, oh, I had to cancel my appointment last week because I had COVID again. And I just, kind of look at them and say, did you get your shots? Are you boosted? Oh, yes, I am. And thank God I was, or I might have died. I mean, I hear the story over and over. I'm like, what is wrong with you people? And these are people that are, I work in an area where the people are, I'm treating doctors, attorneys, engineers, scientists, professors. These are people that are supposed to be intelligent and they don't get it. And I'm like, what? Oh my God, it's just, so infuriating and frustrating, and I almost lost my job. I had to fight very hard at both offices because I refused to get the jab. So and I had a lot of grief from patients coming in giving me a hard time. I had many patients that once they found that out, because they would all ask immediately. I hate to lie to people. Eventually, it got to the point that I lost patients because they would not see me anymore if I didn't have the vaccine. And most of them have come back now realizing that, they've gone other places and they, the service they were getting was still better from an unvaccinated hygienist than some of the vaccinated hygienists.
The unwashed was better service, right? Kat,
exactly.
Good for you for standing tall. And proven right at the end of the
day. I was scared because I'm single. I have to, you know, I only have me to depend on. I don't have a spouse that can pick up the slack or anything like that. So it's my livelihood. It's all I've done since I graduated college, and I've done it for 42 years now. So
bless your heart,
retirement, not anywhere in sight.
Happy Thanksgiving, Kat. I'm grateful to have you here. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Jason, to you too. Happy Thanksgiving.
Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
All right, they have named a new special prosecutor. And will it come as a surprise? Merrick Garland, the bowling alley waitress, has named a special prosecutor. Given that Donald Trump has now declared his candidacy for president, the bowling alley waitress, the guy that is the pretend attorney general, he said, it would be best if we appoint a special counsel to investigate Trump. We'll talk about who that is next.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Thank you, Chris, very much. You have a great show. You have a highly rated show, too, by the way. I can't have been telling you lately.
Good morning, Chris. You're my voice of hope.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Great to be with you today. Hope you're doing well. Hope your weekend was fantastic. Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Former federal prosecutor Andrew C. McCarthy, our dear friend, chief legal beagle of this broadcast. Whenever we need a great legal scholar, we go straight to him. It's been a bit since we've checked in. Happy Thanksgiving week to you, Mr. McCarthy.
Hey, Chris, happy Thanksgiving to you, your listeners, your family. Hope everyone has a wonderful week.
Thank you, my friend. Same to you. Before we start on why we booked you today, which is this special prosecutor, I have to ask you about one particular story that's come out of the Bay Area. And the reason I ask you about it, I typically wouldn't, but it involves the DOJ, which is your wheelhouse. So let me play this for you, if I may. And if you can bear with me for a minute, might take a minute or two. But I'm going to play this for you. This is on the Paul Pelosi attack. Now, we've been talking about this for a while. And questions have been raised about this for a while, and just exactly what happened that night. And one of the biggest questions about that night is who opened the door to let police in. Now, the national media narrative has officially been whatever the DOJ has told them, but there is a pesky NBC affiliate in the San Francisco Bay Area that won't let this drop. And here's how they reported this. Listen. Maybe. Stand by. Hang on. We're going to get there. Maybe. Hang on. Stand by. Well, this might not work. You know what I'm going to do? I'll find it later. But in the meantime, let me just tell you that the punchline is DOJ officially reports that police let themselves in. The police report in San Francisco is, and body camera footage confirms Paul Pelosi let them in.
Right.
So that's the punchline. I wanted to give you some of the more specifics, but why is all of national media parroting what DOJ says while one local affiliate is asking questions and local police saying something different? And who should we listen to here when it comes to law enforcement reporting of this incident?
Well, you know, ordinarily I'd love to be able to say, Chris, that we should listen to law enforcement, but I kind of think they've lost their credibility on this. And, I think they've lost their credibility on a lot of things in terms of, being taken at their word. There's a lot of very curious and peculiar things about the Pelosi story. I don't think it undermines, at least based on what we know now, the charge that's been filed against this guy for assaulting Pelosi, which he apparently did with a hammer. But I think there's a lot of curious things about this. And I have to say, the thing that I found curious, having been for a time under protection while I was prosecuting terrorists in the 90s, I don't for the life of me understand why they don't have a physical presence at the home, even if Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, is not there. That makes no sense to me. You know, when you have a protectee, and now maybe they've changed their procedures over time, but, you know, the obvious thing that you always worry about with a protectee is the, you know, the locations where the person goes regularly, and the home is always a big deal. My understanding is they may have had some video surveillance on the home, but not like a physical presence of security personnel. And I think that's very strange for look, I think everything about this is strange, but that to me is very odd.
What bothers me most is, of course, this incident was used in the closing hours of an election to suggest that this is just more of the same insurrectionist Donald Trump supporters attacking people they don't politically agree with. And I think it is beyond a shadow of a doubt true that none of that story holds up.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It looks like the person who carried this out, you know, I don't think that there's any credible indication that he's at all representative of, you know, any particular coherent ideology. It sounds like he's a problem soul. But I don't like this. I mean, let's say he was he had a MAGA hat on and he was a card carrying Trumpy. That would be one person. I mean, you know, right. It wouldn't mean that that, you know, Chris, who's been more supportive of Trump than I have, that's representative you of any way. And it wouldn't mean that I, who, you know, voted for Trump twice and endorsed him the second time in a big piece in the magazine shortly before the election, that it's representative of me. I mean, this whole idea of using one troubled person to brand an entire group of people who themselves have very diverse views. And if Trump is going to be our metric here, all come to Trump or support Trump in different ways or for different reasons, that's idiotic. And it's something the left regularly does. And you know, weirdly, well, maybe not weirdly, because this is also political, when the shoe is on the other foot, we're never supposed to generalize because yeah. That would be unfair. So, you know, if people are angry at yet another iteration of, you know, two tiers of justice and two tiers of reporting and, you know, politically, basically two tiers of everything, I don't blame them for being angry about it. It makes me angry, too.
If you'll bear with me, only because I think it's important. So many of us were told that we were conspiracy theorists and to shut up about questioning this Paul Pelosi story as anything but innocent Paul Pelosi, sound asleep, crazy man, wielding hammer, breaks in and attacks Paul Pelosi. And we were all supposed to shut up when we asked questions about it. I do want to play a bit of this, if you'll bear with me, because I just want to, for the record, this is the NBC affiliate in San Francisco just in the last couple of days. Here we go. Just a bit of it.
Right.
Information tonight on a story that we've been tracking, the attack on Paul Pelosi, the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Our investigative team looked into why state and federal prosecutors each describe one specific detail of the police response differently. Senior investigative reporter Bagat Shaban has been checking with his sources to try and clear it up. He joins us now, and you've got some answers, Bagat.
Well, Jess, this all has to do with the moments, seconds, really, just before Paul Pelosi was struck in the head with a hammer inside his San Francisco home. Now, there continues to be contradicting accounts of a relatively simple question. Who opened the door that night when San Francisco police arrived to the Pelosi house? Now, the Department of Justice says the two officers opened the door. That's according to a federal indictment filed earlier this week. But the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, in another court document that was filed earlier this month, said Mr. Pelosi opened the door with his left hand. So the question is, what really happened? According to a source familiar with the investigation, who personally watched the police body camera footage from that night, officers knocked on the door of the Pelosi home, then backed away And the video clearly shows Paul Pelosi open the door with his left hand, just like what was noted in the documents filed by the DA's office. Now, also as written in the DA docs, the source tells us the body cam video shows officers having a brief conversation with Pelosi and David DePapp. That's the man accused of breaking into the Pelosi home, before DePapp starts beating Pelosi with a hammer. We reached out to the Department of Justice for an explanation on its differing account of this seemingly innocuous issue of who opened the door, but so far we have not heard back. However, I did get to ask San Francisco DA Brooke Jenkins directly about another issue many people are wondering about earlier this week, based on her office's account of Paul Pelosi opening the door. The case has certainly garnered a fair share of conspiracy theories about what actually happened that night. As part of your investigation, are you able to shed any light as to why Paul Pelosi didn't run out of the house towards police officers when he was able to actually open the door for them when they arrived?
What I'm not able to do is to speculate or try to place my opinion.
Yeah, so, I mean, and it goes on from there. But, Andy, this is important. It's important because everybody who questioned it was told we were liars and kooks. And everything that's common sense about that night tells us something opposite should have happened than what did. So from the phone call he placed from a bathroom, supposedly, where I would have stayed if a guy had broken into my home and I got to my phone and I'm in a bathroom, I would have stayed there behind a closed door. I wouldn't have been able to open my door. I certainly would have exited my house when cops showed up. And DOJ says none of that. And we're all supposed to say, shut up, shut up. Says national media. I resent this deeply, and DOJ is involved, and that's why I'm spending time with you on this, Andy, because this is now a DOJ Capitol Police thing, and it's deeply troubling compared to what local police and local investigators are saying.
So here's what I don't understand, Chris. Like, let's say that we're going to politicize everybody's concern about this, and you're a progressive Democrat, and you want to see justice done for the person who assaulted Paul Pelosi, which I think, you know, frankly, we should all want to see
of
justice
course.
Done, right? Why wouldn't you care intensely about a factual recitation, which was obviously made under oath, and if it was in the grand jury, which, if it turns out to be inaccurate, could blow the case up? I mean, it's just like common sense. I mean, first of all, the reason the national media has backed off is because, you know, everybody's genuflex and is scared to death of Pelosi. And she said at the beginning that, you know, we ask for privacy at this time. And when, you know, a leading progressive Democrat says that, everybody's supposed to march to that tune. But in any other circumstance, if there were contradictions in the police account of what happened that could undermine the ultimate prosecution, that would be major news. And you'd want to know why. The other thing that's, you know, obvious here is if Paul Pelosi let them in, you know, was in a position to let the police in, and then the assault happened, it raises questions about, you know, what the hell were the police doing?
Yes.
And, you know, what about their, you know, how did they allow this to happen under circumstances where if he hadn't been assaulted yet at the time that they came in and it happened in their presence after they were there, the question arises about how the police handled the situation. So to me, this is just like an ordinary news story. And I find that, you know, a lot of my time covering litigation is about exactly this sort of stuff. And the reason it's important is not to have conspiracy theories or gotcha. It's important because prosecutors, when a case ultimately gets to trial, have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And if it turns out that people gave false accounts in the grand jury, I'm not saying this happened, I don't know what happened yet, but if they gave false accounts in the grand jury in order to cover themselves for either incompetence or some kind of misconduct, that's the kind of stuff that makes jury trials crumble. And cases that the prosecutors should win, they end up losing. So I think it's an important story just for that reason.
I'll also say, just to me, it just doesn't sound like Paul Pelosi was under duress. I mean, there's just nothing about this that sounds like an emergency when Paul Pelosi notified authorities.
Yeah, Chris, I don't know if he was or he wasn't. And he doesn't need to be under duress for an assault on him with a hammer to be illegal.
Of course not.
So
I'm just saying up to the Hammer assault is my point.
Yeah, no, I
until he was assaulted. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I would, you know, look, whenever a government official, especially in the grand jury, whenever it turns out, now I don't want to jump to the conclusion of perjury because we don't know all the facts yet. But whenever there's a major contradiction in the account, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, is of utmost importance, which is to say, how did the police get in the first place? That always has the potential of unraveling the whole case, because what juries say is, well, if they lied about that or they got that wrong, what else are they getting wrong? And what else are they not telling us? So I just think it's very important and very curious that it's something that's this straightforward, which you would think you would get a straight explanation on. We haven't gotten a straight explanation on.
All right. Not why you're here, but I appreciate you walking that path with me for a little bit because it interests me, particularly from a DOJ perspective. And so we shift now to DOJ naming a special counsel to investigate Donald Trump. And Merrick Garland rolls out over the weekend and says he's appointing a special counsel because of the nature of Donald Trump declaring his candidacy, as though this wasn't political before. But now Merrick Garland's very concerned about the optics of politics. And so he appoints Jack Smith, a war crimes prosecutor in The Hague, former chief of DOJ's public integrity section. And you react how, Andy McCarthy?
Well, you know, look, I think I don't like special counsels, but, you know, there are regulations about when they're supposed to be appointed. I find this one to be curious and ironic at the same time, because I don't really, you know, the normal situation is you worry about the incumbent government concocting a case to remove a political rival from the field, so to speak, you know, from being able to contest, say, an election. Here, I think it's a very complicated situation because I think Biden actually wants to run against Trump. But one way or the other, I think Garland does not want to be seen as in the position that he's actually in, which is that he has to make a decision about whether these cases get prosecuted or not. So he's trying to create the illusion of detachment and distance from that decision. But it's smoke and mirrors, because a special counsel reports to the attorney general in any event. So it's about as real as Biden running around saying he has nothing to do with the Justice Department, that runs as if it's an unaccountable fourth branch of government and he doesn't oversee it. In fact, Biden, you know, the Justice Department answers to Biden, and the special counsel answers to the Justice Department, which answers to Biden. So the whole thing is an effort to create an illusion of detachment, as if this thing is completely separated from politics. And there are some things, Chris, that you just can't separate from politics because they're fraught with politics. They're by nature political. And if you have, you know, I mean, the Hillary Clinton investigation, let's, you know, just go back to that to compare. It wasn't the FBI's fault that Hillary Clinton put in a half-baked, you know, this ridiculous communications, unsecured communications system that she used for her government communications. But once she did, that caused a criminal investigation of somebody who was seeking the highest public office. That's by nature political. There's nothing you can do about it. And if you're going to investigate Trump, you know, he may very well, has he committed crimes? I guess we're going to see. But the thing is, if you open a criminal investigation against somebody who is a political figure, not only a former president, but someone who is now seeking the office in the 2024 contest, that's going to be fraught with politics. Biden and Garland wanted these jobs. And sometimes, you know, they're hard jobs because some things are by nature political, and you can't erase the politics of a situation that's fraught with politics by tinkering around with the organization chart. I mean, in the end, Biden will make the final call about whether Trump gets charged or not. And that's just a fact. So, you know, they can do whatever they want to do about it. It's true.
So
and it doesn't mean it's Biden's fault, but that's the nature of the beast.
And by the way, this guy, I mean, this my words, not yours, and maybe you'll disagree. Jack Smith, do you know who this guy is? He's tied to a lot. He's tied to the IRS Lois Lerner thing. He's tied to the Ted Stevens, the late Alaska senator investigation. He's tied to the Bob McDonnell investigation, all of which were fraught with, let's call it, at minimum, questionable behaviors and activities from his office as he headed these investigations. The Supreme Court even weighed in, I think, on the McDonnell Bob McDonnell thing in Virginia. So this Jack Smith guy is questionable at best.
Well, you know, look, but you're completely fair to raise all this, not least because if Merrick Garland has done this for the sake of appearances, then all that is relevant, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones who started this, right? They're the ones. There's no reason that Garland had to have a special counsel here. He could have just, like, been a big boy and made the decision himself, but he doesn't want to be seen as making the decision himself. So he created this illusion to alter people's perception of how these decisions are going to be made. And if you're going to play that game, then everything about Smith's – and I don't know Smith from a hole in the wall. So, you know, I'm willing to see what happens here. I've been following the cases closely, so I think I'll be able to figure out whether he's playing it straight or not. But the fact of the matter is, if Garland does this for the sake of appearances, then why aren't you allowed to, you know, make relevant observation about how it appears?
Final question, Andy McCarthy. Can you just handicap how this plays out? I mean, let's just walk it out. I know there's a ton of what ifs. Yep. Lots can happen. But let's just assume Donald Trump becomes the nominee for the Republicans. And Donald Trump goes on to challenge. And let's just assume Joe Biden is running again. I'm just trying to, like, I don't know where the Biden people go with this. Do you try to prosecute the guy you're running against, which is ironically the whole reason he was impeached the first time? Trump was impeached for trying to target his eventual political rival, Joe Biden, even though he was nowhere close to even declaring being president at the time. But nevertheless, I mean, Biden, people screamed that Trump should have been impeached for a phone call that targeted Biden the first time. So what does it look like when Biden and his DOJ are trying to prosecute a guy that's running for office against him?
Well, first of all, Biden would say that he didn't agitate for this, whereas in the Trump situation, you know, we have him in this phone call asking for an investigation. By the way, asking the Ukrainians to conduct an investigation of an American. So, you know, I'm not sure that the analogy holds up, but I mean, as long as you've asked me to handicap, I think.
Well, the underlying premise is Trump was motivated trying to kneecap an eventual political opponent. That was what
correct.
They said.
Right.
And Biden hadn't even declared a candidacy at that time. But I digress.
Well, yeah, no, but I just think it's a different matter. It's one thing to ask your own Justice Department, which you control, to do it. It's another thing to ask a foreign government to go after an American citizen, whether he's a political rival or not. I think that's a...
Well, I think they wanted information. I don't know if it was go after. Do you? I mean, I don't...
I think they wanted an investigation. And
well, but what could Ukraine have ever done? I mean, Rudy Giuliani wasn't asking Ukraine to prosecute.
I don't know about that. I think they were asking them to prosecute... You know,
well, anyway, neither here nor there. I mean, the optics of this? I mean, Donald Trump's the candidate and he's running against Biden. So what are we to make of that?
Well, I think it entirely depends, Chris, on whether you think it's a good faith investigation or not. So I think, for example, if they had ordered this and it turned out that what they were trying to investigate was Russiagate, which was a completely made up thing, then it would be a massive, massive abuse of power. On the other hand, if you think that what's underlying this investigation is actual criminal conduct or something that at least people, investigators in good faith could believe were serious violations of law, then, you know, the question becomes, what's the government supposed to do about it? I mean, yes, you don't want the specter of the incumbent administration investigating its political rival. But at the same time, the political rival doesn't have immunity from violating the law.
So let's go
down to is it a serious case or not?
Yeah. And so punchline this. OK, so they I don't know. They come out what before the election and say he's guilty of crimes. And then what? I mean, well, are we prosecuting him? Is he found guilty? How does it play out?
Well, here's how I think it works. Number one, I think they already think they have a prosecutable case on the Mar-a-Lago documents. They really want to get them on January 6th if they could figure out a way to do that. I don't think they have a case on January 6th, but they're trying to make one. So I think what's going on here is they would like to run against Trump, and they're using this to try to basically they want to slow walk the investigation. And as long as he's politically viable, I don't think he'll be charged. And what I mean by politically viable is as long as he is a favorite or at least a legitimate competitor in the Republican primary, I don't think they'll charge him because if they charge him, that would really destroy his campaign. I think people would say, you know, it doesn't matter whether President Trump is innocent or guilty. What matters is we need to have a viable candidate who can beat Biden in the election, and that just complicates things too much. So I don't think they're going to pull the trigger, and what they hope is that he'll win the nomination, and then they can indict him, or then at least they could, you know, it becomes a big issue in the campaign that they're holding over his head. I think the minute he becomes not a viable Republican candidate, he'll be charged. So if, for example, he were to sink in the polls, or DeSantis, let's just play it out and say DeSantis or someone else like zoomed so far out in front of him that it became clear that the money raising that Trump would have to do to mount a viable campaign and the likelihood of him winning the early primaries diminished. I think at that point, if they thought he was not a viable candidate anymore, that like his time had passed and he was not a viable candidate for the Republican nomination, they'd just charge him.
Yeah, I am imagining a Donald Trump candidacy. I'm imagining November 2024 or October 2024. And Donald Trump's been indicted by Joe Biden's DOJ.
Yep.
And then I'm imagining just for fun, Donald Trump wins. Then what?
Right. Well, you know, we get back into the whole business that we dealt with in the Mueller situation, right, about whether a sitting president can be prosecuted or not. And I think the Justice Department guidance is you can't indict a sitting president. And so the idea would be told until he was out of his presidency. I've been asked these questions in the last few days because we've never been under this situation before.
But of course
just in
not.
Case people are curious, the only thing the Constitution says is that a person has to be over 35 and an American citizen, a natural born American citizen. Other than that, there are no qualifications. So for like everyone who's asked me, can you be president from jail? The answer to that question is it doesn't matter what Andy thinks should happen. The Constitution doesn't prohibit it. So,
look, this is amazing. I have a very funny feeling you and I are going to be talking for years and years to come about this.
Well, it depends on how long the sentence is, right?
Andrew C. McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, my friend, it's always a pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thanks, Chris. You too.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Join me weekday mornings at 11 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Will run, takes it in, touchdown! Nothing in front of him except the end zone.
I think Barstool Philly, as they so often do, summarizes the fan base feelings well. I hate being an Eagles fan. It's awesome. I hate being an Eagles fan. It's awesome. Here from the Farzi Show, the host, Mark Farzetta. Catch it on YouTube, on Twitch, Apple, Spotify, FarziShow.com. Contributor over there at Fox Sports, Fox 29 here locally. Mark, I hate being an Eagles fan. It's awesome. Pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
I had not seen that, but that is the perfect way to sum it up. Absolutely. I like it when a lot is said in few words. That's perfect.
Because it was ugly. And I must say, you know, as a Kansas City Chiefs fan, one of the disheartening, curious, frustrating, irritating losses for the Chiefs this season was to the Colts. And I watched most of that game versus the Eagles yesterday, and I thought, are they really going to do this to the Eagles too? They almost did, but the Eagles figured it out there at the end.
Yeah, I know Jeff Saturday becoming the head coach has gotten all the headlines, but the bottom line is they have a great defensive coordinator in Gus Bradley, and I felt two things really contributed to the Eagles' offense struggling yesterday, and that was, number one, Gus Bradley being a really good defensive coordinator and knowing what to do against any variety of types of quarterbacks, especially really good ones and really versatile ones like Jalen Hurts. And then the other was Dallas Goedert not being in the game plan because of his obvious injury he suffered Monday night, the loss against the Commanders. One thing I always go back to, and if people have heard me say this before, they're probably sick of me saying it, but I think it is one of the biggest testaments to how vital Dallas Goedert is to the game plan. And it has to do with a few years ago when the Eagles were playing in Atlanta, Dallas Goedert was one of many Eagles offensive players that went down with a soft tissue injury just before kickoff, literally sustained the injury during pregame warmups. And I remember after the game being back in the NovaCare complex talking to Jason Kelsey on that Tuesday. And Jason Kelsey talked about how they had to rip up and throw away half their run plays because Dallas Goedert, who at the time was either a rookie or his second season in the NFL, wasn't in the lineup. And he was, of course, vital to the passing game as a receiving target for then Carson Wentz. But in the run game was just as vital, if not more vital, because of how well of a how good he blocks. He is a phenomenal blocking tight end. And the Eagles were really trying to figure out a lot of different things yesterday, not just because of their opponent and what Gus Bradley was putting in front of them and the talent he had, like a guy like Yannick Ngakoue coming off the edge, but also a guy like Dallas Goedert not being out there, I think was a huge hitch in the Eagles' offensive giddy-up yesterday. And I don't think that showed more than when Yannick Ngakoue got to Jalen Hurts, where he only had to get by Miles Sanders and force the fumble at the start of the second half. So those were two things, mainly offensively speaking, that I think the Eagles were trying to feel their way around yesterday.
By the way, it is important to note, and kind of frustrating to note, that don't look now, but getting pretty hot, or looking hot anyway, of all things, the Washington Commanders.
Ugh.
What is going on there? Or is that a fluke?
I think it will. I put it this way. I don't think the Washington Commanders are making the playoffs. So let me just get that out of the way. I don't think what they're doing is going to be sustained. I don't think it's sustainable. I think what they're going through right now is something similar to what the Cowboys went through when Dak Prescott was out. Not that Carson Wentz, I don't think, is going to come back and retake the starting reins, but I think what Taylor Heinicke is doing right now is playing a good brand of football, not a great brand of football, but he's allowing that team to play elevated football. I won't say great, I won't say elite, but he is allowing that defense to really take over and dictate what needs to happen for them to win. He is doing a good job of managing games. He is still making big plays, but mostly managing the game, not giving the football away, and letting a defense rise above that. I think Jack Del Rio and Ron Rivera are doing a pretty decent job of organizing the talent they have on that side of the football. So I think what they're doing right now is playing above their bar, well above their bar. I think they will overall play better than what we saw at the start of the season. But I don't think what they're doing is sustainable to the point where they're going to be a playoff threat.
It's just interesting to see when teams start to get hot at this time, you start to kind of wonder, well, things could get interesting. Similarly, the Cowboys, not just a win, but and you hate to say it or see it, but dominated Minnesota.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. Minnesota coming off a huge win in Buffalo. One of the craziest games I've ever watched, without question, features the greatest catch I've ever seen by Justin Jefferson, and they were given many opportunities. They were left for dead on many different occasions, and yet they kept coming back, and they won a very emotional game. They played a very tough defense, a very tough opponent at home, coming off a game like that, coming off a high like that. I did not expect the Vikings to win that game. I expected the Cowboys to win that game. I did not expect the dominating performance that they did put out there, but they played a perfect game. The Cowboys played a perfect game, and I know this question gets asked every single time a Cowboys win could possibly or will possibly help the Eagles scenario. Were you rooting for the Cowboys? No. No one in the Delaware Valley that's an Eagles fan should be rooting for the Cowboys. However, now let me go politics here for a second. Okay. However, you can play both sides sometimes. And the words you use are very important to how you frame your argument. The political way to say it is, no, I wasn't rooting for the Cowboys, but I was rooting for the best possible scenario for the Eagles. The Giants losing and the Vikings losing was the best possible scenario for the Eagles. The Eagles are alone with the best record in the NFL now at 9-1. There's no other team with that good a record, so the Vikings take the hit. Right now, if the season ended today, the Eagles' home field advantage, number one seed, that's what I'm rooting for at this point. To me, rooting against the Cowboys is fine, but in yesterday's scenario, rooting for the best possible outcome for the Eagles is what all Eagles fans should have been rooting for yesterday.
But you don't see – here's the thing with the Eagles. The performance yesterday, even though I know you said we're missing some – you know, we're handicapped with some injuries.
A little bit, sure.
But I wonder, with the first loss and then a sort of a wobbly performance, I wonder, you know, it's one of those seasons where you just steamroll through the front half and maybe you blow a tire in the second half. Are you concerned about that or no?
It's certainly possible. Stranger things have happened. I mean, I think last time we spoke, I was talking about a Cardinals team that started out 7-0 last year and then barely went .500 the rest of the way. So, yeah, it's absolutely possible. And the fact that they are missing such an integral part of their own, like people talk about losing superstars, like a Cardinals team not having DeAndre Hopkins as a wide receiver, the Eagles not having a guy like Miles Sanders for a lot of last year. Not that he's a superstar, but he's a star on this offense, certainly. People talk about losing those individual players for the one aspect that they bring, whether or not they catch touchdowns, whether or not they throw touchdowns, whether or not they run for touchdowns. The thing that's interesting about Dallas Goedert is the fact that he can do a lot on his own and that he can open up the field for a lot of other players or protect players. So, I mean, we talk about versatility in quarterbacks all the time. I don't think we talk about it enough with tight ends because a guy like Travis Kelce, who's the best catching tight end in all of football, can't block like Dallas Goedert. Now, who would I rather have, Travis Kelce or Dallas Goedert? I'd rather have Travis Kelce. He's the best tight end in the game. But the versatility that Dallas Goedert brings affects so many other things on the football field that the Eagles are still trying to figure that out. The more impressive thing to me, and a reason why I don't think the Eagles are going to hit that lull is because, and I give them a lot of credit for this, Howie Roseman went out there and addressed a huge need with Ndamukong Suh and Linval Joseph. Now, neither one of those guys are Pro Bowl stature anymore. Neither one of those guys. Fletcher Cox isn't even Pro Bowl stature anymore. But those three guys now being added, those two guys being added to Fletcher Cox and Javon Hargrave, and then having guys on the outside like Reddick and obviously guys like Josh Sweat and Brandon Graham, who had a huge play yesterday, that defensive line with those two acquisitions took a huge step forward. And Howie Roseman addressed the issue that a lot of teams started to game plan for with the Eagles in terms of running the ball right up the middle of the field. In getting Sue and getting Joseph, what you did was eliminate that threat for guys like Aaron Jones, who you're about to face with the Green Bay Packers, when you face Ezekiel Elliott and Tony Pollard again, and when you face Saquon Barkley two other times this season, and Derrick Henry coming up, I believe, in 2 weeks to face the Eagles. So you have teams that are going to run the football predominantly on the Eagles and try to take advantage of that middle of the line of scrimmage. And what you did was essentially plug up that hole and add two guys that even if they just stand there, give you a better chance as to what you than what you had before in facing that type of stout running offense that you're going to be seeing as the season closes out.
So, yes, it's possible, but I think the Eagles have put themselves in the best possible scenario to, A, fight against it head on, and, B, actually get guys to help you win down the line.
Listen, I'm not one of these guys that likes to look this far ahead when it comes to football. I refuse to do it, but I've been asked more than a few times. Stigall, what are you going to do if the Kansas City Chiefs meet the Philadelphia Eagles? What are you going to do? I said, I will happily have that discussion once we get there. But there's a lot that has to happen before we get to that place. That said, sure, you brought him up. Travis Kelce just passed Rob Gronkowski for the most 100-yard receiving games by a tight end in NFL history last night. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, he is Mr. Consistent. I am a huge Travis Kelce fan, and it's got nothing to do. I mean, look, Gronk was a party boy, too, and he's a lot of fun, but the consistency is the biggest thing, and Gronk is obviously very consistent. But Travis Kelce, it's just like, I mean, if you play fantasy football, I mean, the drop-off between him and then like maybe 2 and 3 in the NFL in terms of production and consistency, it might be the biggest drop-off at any other position group throughout the entire league. So if you draft him every year, which I did not this year, unfortunately, if you draft him, you know you're getting consistency. You know you're getting numbers. You know that when Patrick Mahomes has that look on his face of, well, nothing's open, so let me buy some time, and then eventually I'll find Travis Kelce, you know that big play is coming. And the other crazy thing about it is you talk about versatility. I mean, the guy's all about scoring. I mean, in basketball, yeah, we talk about it all the time. Is the guy a scorer? Travis Kelce is the definition of a scorer. You line him up in shotgun, the guy runs up the middle for a touchdown. The guy can throw a touchdown pass. The guy obviously catches him. The guy just, he creates points. And
if you want something just highly entertaining to listen to, by the way, he and his brother, Jason and Travis Kelce on a podcast is pretty darn funny. If you like listening to a couple of brothers talk football and razz one another, it's very funny stuff.
It is. It's a great podcast. Absolutely.
Mark Farzetta, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. Thank you as always, my friend.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, and you better, and I know you would, root for the Chiefs when they do meet the Eagles in the Super Bowl. So no big deal.
I'll have to.
You know what is appreciated in Philadelphia above all else? People being real, and that would be very real of you, because that's your squad. Thanks, brother. If he's with me, I'll blink the light to let you know
tonight's the night for me and you. My box died. Oh, yeah, they're all out. The blame game is on. Governor Christie was out over the weekend singing the same song from the same hymnal as every other Republican. Everything about Election Day was Trump and Trump's fault.
We keep losing and losing and losing. And the fact of the matter is, the reason we're losing is because Donald Trump has put himself before everybody else.
Yeah. This was the big confab, the Republican Jewish coalition, where all the presumptive frontrunners speak.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for doing what you're doing in the media.
Good morning, Chris. I listen to you every morning. Thanks.
Hey, Mr. Segal, may he whose father gave us life keep you well and safe.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by go, you know the thing.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Michael Torres at Real Clear Pennsylvania has written a piece that does not surprise me. The audacity continues to astound me, but it doesn't surprise me. Pennsylvania GOP leaders point to Trump for midterm losses. Here to talk about it is Michael Torres, who has authored this piece at realclearpennsylvania.com. We heard Chris Christie. Let me play this for you again, Michael, before we get started. And first of all, welcome. Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving week to you, sir.
Good morning, Chris, and happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Governor Christie of the Garden State at the Republican Jewish Coalition.
And the fact of the matter is the reason we're losing is because Donald Trump has put himself before everybody else. And I understand and believe in so many of the policies that were able to be accomplished during those 4 years. I mourn what more could have been done. And let's remember this. Everything that has happened in the last 2 years is because we lost that election.
And it's Donald Trump's fault. So that's Chris Christie there on the national stage on behalf of the Republican Party. Effectively, you can assume that that's probably what most GOP insiders think. Like Christie, I mean, he headed the Republican Governors Association, for heaven's sake. So, Michael Torres, bring it back to the Keystone State. What have you learned from Pennsylvania leaders in their autopsy of the midterms?
Well, Chris, after the election, I called up people all across the state at both the county and state level in the Pennsylvania GOP. And suffice it to say that there is a large group of them who are not happy with former President Donald Trump or State Senator Doug Mastriano, who ran for governor. And they're laying the blame at both of their feet for the significant loss back on November 8th. And a lot of them are looking for a way for the party to move on so that they can find candidates that they think will be more competitive on a statewide level in 2024. And some are very explicit in saying that they don't want Donald Trump to be at the top of the ticket in a couple of years.
How many of these geniuses talked about ballot casting votes and early voting? How many of them? Many of them? Did that come up at all?
It actually did. I tried to get a good gist before writing the article of their general takeaways, what happened in the election, what went wrong, what went right. The blaming of Donald Trump and Doug Mastriano was sort of the through line of all the people that I spoke to. But several of them also brought up mail ballots. One person, the county Pennsylvania GOP chair in Cambria County, sorry, out there in western Pennsylvania. She said that the Pennsylvania GOP really needs to stop complaining about mail ballots, get on the bandwagon and get as many people to vote as soon as possible because they're losing a lot of people to early voting. Like the Democrats have such a great ground game on. Her party just doesn't have that much of an outreach. And she's seeing a lot of voters who are both sort of disenfranchising themselves because they don't believe that the election system is fair. So they're choosing not to vote, or they don't think their vote's going to count, so they're not as enthusiastic. Or everyone's just waiting until election day, and in her view, that's really dampening the number of Republicans that come out to vote in the end.
Okay, so you talk to one smart person. She actually gets it. Because if there's a single Republican leader in Pennsylvania that doesn't understand what you just said, that woman said, then they're fools. I mean, literally, you can talk about Donald Trump till you're blue in the face. But if every Republican in Pennsylvania doesn't understand what that woman told you, I don't care who you run. I don't care if the Pope, I don't care if it's, you know, Reagan comes back to life. You run anybody you want. Democrats are out hustling and outnumbering people with early voting, period, full stop. And Republicans better understand that in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, Republicans have a fantastic ground game when it comes to election day. And across the country, you saw that happen. Republicans are very good at getting a lot of volunteers out for one day of the year to get a lot of people to come to the polls on that one day. However, Democrats are very good at getting people to come out for several weeks, and they don't have to go out. They just have to fill out a ballot on their kitchen table and put it in the mailbox, which is a lot easier in most cases, especially with elderly people who tend to vote very Republican, especially in a state like Pennsylvania. More people over the age of 50 vote Republican than Democrat. So it behooves Republicans to jump on the mail voting bandwagon because it's the law in the state, and it's unlikely for the law to be changed now that Shapiro is going to be in the governor's office. So this is just the reality that Republicans have to live with in the state of Pennsylvania. But beyond mail balloting, a lot of Republicans also saw a very large underperformance in counties that you would expect Republicans to perform extremely well in, such as Westmoreland and Washington County out in western Pennsylvania, and the counties around Erie. Very, very disappointing showing among Republicans in that area. And that's where a lot of the blame casting is coming from. The Republican leaders are looking at those counties and saying, why in the world were we not getting humongous leads there? There's no reason for it. Something was dampening Republican spirits or pushing people towards Shapiro.
Okay, so are we talking about turnout or shifting votes? What do you know? Because I still haven't looked at these numbers, and that's on me. I'm sorry. Do you know anything about Republican turnout, physical, like people that voted, in, you know, for Trump in 16, maybe again in 20, didn't show up in 2022? Or do we have that data yet? Or do we know?
So that is always hard to discern after an election. However, there's data points that you can kind of connect the dots and try to make an educated guess. According to exit poll data analyzed by the Wall Street Journal after the election, 5% more Republicans voted than Democrats voted in the last election. So there was higher Republican turnout. Nevertheless, Josh Shapiro won by 14%. That indicates that a huge portion of Republicans voted for Shapiro instead of Mastriano. And that likely indicates that Mastriano was a very large drag on the ticket for Mehmet Oz. And those polls that showed Oz with a slim lead may have been correct. However, the polls obviously discounted the extent to which there would be split ticket voting in favor of Shapiro, and thereby making more ballots more blue. And that came home to roost in, I mentioned Westmoreland County, for example. That's where Donald Trump had his last pre-election rally for Oz and Mastriano. It is where the Pennsylvania Republican's most powerful state Republican is, Senator Kim Ward. She's now in charge of the state Senate. She won in 2020 by 34% there. Mastriano won by 6%. Humongous underperformance there. Just absolutely devastating for the Republican Party. You cannot win that county by a mere 6% when just across the county border you're going to lose Pittsburgh by a huge margin. You have to run up the numbers there. And so a lot of Republicans are looking at it and saying, hey, our message did not get across to Republican voters there, especially ones who are willing to split their ticket.
Yeah, and here's the thing. The curious thing is, if you're someone in Pennsylvania who voted for Donald Trump twice and then saw fit to vote for Josh Shapiro, Republicans are going to have to do some soul searching, because I mean, you can blame Doug Mastriano, but the idea, and this is what's driven me nuts. I mean, this is one of my, I think that's just obvious and true. Shapiro ran from the jump with gobs and gobs and gobs and gobs of money and absolutely no opposition, no primary. He was coronated from the jump. He was never questioned. He was never scrutinized. He was never analyzed. He never had to speak unless he wanted to speak. We have never, not since Barack Obama, I would argue, ever seen a Democrat just coast. And Obama didn't get this kind of grace. I mean, Obama was scrutinized heavier than Shapiro. I've never seen, Michael Torres, in my life, someone just ascend to an election like Josh Shapiro did. And that's independent of the candidacy of Mastriano. Josh Shapiro was coronated from day one. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that there was unanimous support in the Democrat Party prior to the election, or prior to the primary election, to ensure that he got the nomination and that no one else challenged him. And there was a very interesting column in the Philadelphia Inquirer last week. I can't remember the exact author, but it basically said liberals kept quiet during the election because we knew we needed to beat Mastriano, but now it's time for Shapiro to ignore all of his moderate stances that he took during the election so he could win. So that really underscores the extent to which even progressives in the party were willing to be quiet, not throw a fuss, and let the party establishment do what needed to be done in their eyes to ensure that a very, very competitive candidate got a lot of money and would be given a very significant chance to win the election. And quite frankly, it worked, whereas the Republican side, they beat the heck out of each other. spent millions and millions of dollars tarnishing each other for months. And then at the end, Mastriano came out with a very large plurality, but absolutely no money and a very split party behind him.
Yeah, like I don't it's it's tough for me to go along with the Mastriano was a terrible candidate when from the very beginning. And I'm not saying that we can't criticize Mastriano. Of course that we can. And there's lots of reasons and ways to find cause to criticize. But when you start with open rejection and rebellion from the Republican Party saying that they're going with Shapiro, and you've got a guy in Shapiro that has been moneyed and not scrutinized, no media, no debates, nothing. You know, it's like it's very difficult for me. You know, it's just difficult for me to pile on Mastriano and say, well, a better candidate could have taken him. I don't know who. Honest to goodness, name the Republican. Any one of the nine that ran in the primary, name the Republican that could have beaten that juggernaut of Josh Shapiro. I don't know who it would have been, sincerely.
I don't know if anybody would be able to answer that question, quite frankly. A lot of people talked about Dave White and how he was very well known in the southeastern region of the state and might have had a better chance there. But it's hard to look back and predict what could have happened and how the party could have chosen a different candidate to go on against go against Shapiro because he was just so well funded and had so much support in the state. However, that kind of brings up a problem with the way the Republican Party is run and gets to the heart of the article that I wrote, because a lot of them are saying, a lot of people in the state GOP are saying, look, we need to stop with the very divisive primaries that we're having. Unlike the Democrat Party, we really pick each other apart. And what they want is to be able to endorse a candidate and have the rest of the party get behind it. You have to get behind that candidate. The problem is that you have a very split party where some people very much want to support the candidate that Trump would nominate. And that often is not the candidate that the establishment in the party would nominate. So the Pennsylvania GOP is going to have to figure that out. Otherwise, they're going to continue picking each other apart while Democrats continue to nominate people like Shapiro with very strong backing.
And I also would just say to most of the brainiacs in the Pennsylvania GOP, is it lost on them that the only guy that has managed to achieve statewide victory for Republicans for president of the United States in the last 20 years has been Donald Trump? I mean, is that lost on them? They so definitively say it's Trump's fault we lost. Trump's literally the only guy that made you guys relevant. And there's no denying that either. So, I mean, we can talk about Trump's faults and flaws today. But how as a Pennsylvania Republican, you don't understand the only reason you're even relevant statewide is because of him. People have been talking about Pennsylvania being a unicorn well before the days of Mitt Romney, you know, McCain before that. I mean, Barack Obama, no Republican stood a shot in Pennsylvania until Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think a lot of people that I spoke to definitely said that they supported Donald Trump in 2016. They worked to help his campaign and very much enjoyed his presidency. But the common theme after saying those qualifiers is, but it's time to move on, or that the electorate has started to move on. It was great back in 2016. It's not great now. And I think a very striking quote that I got from the Erie County executive, who's a Republican, the first Republican county executive in several, I think over a decade, maybe two decades. He basically said that what it's come down to now in voters' minds is that Donald Trump is a double-edged sword for Republicans. You have to get through the primary, in which you have to be very, very supportive of Donald Trump. But then when you come out of the primary and go to the general election, you have to compete in a swing county like Erie, where being the most Trump-supporting candidate can be a hindrance to moderate voters who are saying now, hey, look, I've been hearing about this guy for 7 years. What about inflation? What about my schools? What about my grocery bills? What about the crime on the streets? And that's where Shapiro and all of his money did a very good job of very, very strictly labeling Mastriano as the Trump guy, the 2020 election fraud guy. Here's our arguments about inflation. Here's our debate about education. It's you're either choosing the guy who is a replica, a redo of Donald Trump and rewind to 2016, or I'm going to fix your problems. And Republicans did a bad job of countering that argument.
Stipulated, except here's the caveat to that, Michael Torres at Real Clear Pennsylvania. The most radical, I would argue, maybe since those doofuses down in Georgia, those Democrats, Ossoff and Warnock, the Lord of the Rings law firm, I call it. Not since those two have we seen someone as radical left, not to mention incapacitated, as John Fetterman win statewide. There was nothing moderate about John Fetterman. Nothing. And, of course, we know that damn near a million ballots were cast before Election Day. I think you could argue hundreds of thousands of people hadn't even seen him or his condition. But anyway, neither here nor there, whether the guy is incapacitated, physically unable to do the job, he was a radical, Michael Torres. There was nothing moderate about John Fetterman.
Oh, absolutely not. I agree with you on that one. He'll go into the Senate and he'll be very much a Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez type of lawmaker, if you can call them lawmakers. They don't really pass very much legislation, those two, but he will be a lot like them. A lot of tweets, a lot of Green New Deal type proposals that come out on social media. And that's very much who Pennsylvania decided to elect this time. And if my colleague,
so is that? My point is, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but so that does not wash that that's Donald Trump's fault. That's the anti-Trump as ever. I mean, there's nothing less Trump than John Fetterman. So a more moderate fella like Mitt what like who Mitt Romney, like who could have come along and overcome that? If Donald Trump wasn't the guy or wasn't around or didn't have anything to do with the election, like it's just such a stupid. The people that cast votes for John Fetterman were not going to be charmed by someone a little more moderate than Dr. Oz, for heaven's sakes.
Now, I think there's a few different ways to look at it. Number one is the demeanor, the character that Fetterman put on with his outfits and the working man attitude he sort of put on, even though he never was a working man. It definitely had sway, and it was pushed by the media, and a lot of people seemed to believe the character that he put on. The second one is that Dr. Oz's primary message in the last month of the campaign was crime. And while that is an extremely important issue, and it definitely registered on issue polls before the election, as my colleague Charles McElwee wrote recently in a City Journal article, crime is a big issue in other places for most voters. It's a big issue in Philadelphia, and it's a big issue in Pittsburgh and some other large towns. But in suburbia and places where there's a lot of high turnout of swing voters, crime is somewhere else. It's not in their neighborhoods. Whereas other issues, especially economic stuff, is something that is very every single day to them.
I agree with that.
And economy. And so Oz definitely missed an opportunity in that one by really, instead of labeling himself as someone who could fix the economy and fix crime and fix other things, more focusing on the negatives of Fetterman, which kind of hit a brick wall. And the last one is that there seems to be a large number of voters who kind of, quite frankly, this might not be great to hear for a lot of people on the Republican side, are saying, you know what, I'll take crime, I'll take a radical Democrat, I'll take inflation, I just don't want to vote for the Trumpy guy again. And there's a lot of people in Montgomery County, Delaware County, outside of Pittsburgh, who are Obama, Trump, Shapiro voters. They go back and forth. And it seems to me, and it's according to the data, that a lot of folks are choosing that route. And that's something that the Republican Party has to take seriously.
Yeah, the what you have said is just true, and it's something Republicans are going to have to get around somehow. Josh Shapiro and John Fetterman are not who they ran as. They are not who as they appear. John Fetterman is not a working class man. John Fetterman is a radical leftist, and he's very, very wealthy, and he comes from great wealth. Similarly, Josh Shapiro is not a moderate, and he will not govern as a moderate, make bank on that. But they both had a lot of money and a lot of help and a lot of cover, and a huge, massive early turnout in votes well before Election Day. So all of that combines for the perfect storm and a win for Democrats. I don't care who the Republican is. I mean, it just doesn't matter. And if Republicans in Pennsylvania don't figure that out, they're it's a loser's game every time.
And if I could point out one last piece of data, if you look at Washington County out in western Pennsylvania, it's just south of Pittsburgh. You can thank Washington County for your natural gas when you're heating your home this winter. That's where a lot of it comes from. Donald Trump won that county by 25% in 2016. And Mitt Romney won it by like 23%, I believe, in 2012. It's a very red county in recent decades. Mastriano won it by 2%. Meaning he's underperforming both Trump and Mitt Romney by 22%. Massive underperformance. And the chairman of the Washington County GOP told me, he said, we had 23 congressmen come out to present their commitment to America, which was the House GOP's economic plan and what they believed they were going to govern by. He said that lasted two news cycles and no voters in the area ever heard about it again. Instead, everything that was on the airwaves was Josh Shapiro's messaging about how Mastriano was extreme, and no one else really heard about Doug Mastriano, very little about Dr. Oz. Their message didn't get to those voters, and you're seeing that there's a large portion of voters in that very red area who are willing to switch their votes to the Democrat side if they hear a message that they agree with.
Yeah, and how many of them cast their vote early? I mean, that's another thing that I just, boy, mail-in voting, mail-in voting. Dick Morris said it. Republicans have their couch potatoes, too. You got to go find them. You got to go get them. I mean, look, Congress is in Republican hands today because New York and California Republicans figured out how to take advantage of their ballot harvesting laws. And they literally harvest them there in states like New York and California. So the mail-in vote is the new game. Election day is dead. And I do hope Republicans in Pennsylvania understand that and stop blaming personalities personally. Michael Torres, brilliant analysis. Thank you for doing the heavy lifting. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Anytime, Chris.
Michael Torres at realclearpennsylvania.com. Pennsylvania GOP leaders point to Trump for midterm losses. And if any single Republican leader anywhere is telling themselves, if you run a county party, if you're part of a Republican committee, and you listen to this show and you tell yourself that Donald Trump is the reason for last election, you are lying to yourself, and you'd better get your butt in gear, and your organization better get its butt in gear and understand that Election Day is dead. And this get out the vote on Election Day stuff is dead. If you don't understand, you got out hustled. You got your butt kicked by people who wanted it more and ran harder and collected ballots well before Election Day. If you don't get that and you want to keep running around and blaming personalities, you shouldn't be in party leadership. Oh, yeah. All the right people are out this weekend. Chris Christie, Bill Barr, Paul Ryan. They're all giving interviews about how Trump would be a terrible mistake and he's unelectable. They've all the right people are saying it. And I want to know who among them think they could beat him. Who's the man or woman that thinks they're going to step up and beat Donald Trump in a Republican primary? Because I'll tell you right now, there may be one who could make a case, but it's going to be the fight of his life. To such a degree, I'm not sure he wants it right now. And if I were counseling him, if it were me, and I were very specifically, purposely wanting to set him up for ultimate success... Now, I'm just cynically, selfishly, politically, if it's and I'm not thinking about the future of the country, I'd tell Ron DeSantis, hold your fire and wait. There's every reason in the world for Ron DeSantis to just wait this out. It's a jump ball in four more years, or, well, I guess six more years. Like, if you're Ron DeSantis, there's all the reason in the world to not continue to build your political capital in Florida. Let Trump, if you believe that Donald Trump's a disaster and he's going to flame out, then let him. And then you walk in as the heir apparent. You ascend. Nobody argues. Nobody's going to fight it. But other than Ron DeSantis, name the man or woman that could possibly take on Donald Trump and win the nomination right now. And I say to you again, for all of you who don't like it, you're going to have to deal with what's true. There are tens of millions of registered Republican voters in this country who love Donald Trump and will not leave him, no matter how much you wish they would. And that's something that these people who are all saying, it's time to move on from Trump. Yeah, well, I told myself, well, it's not totally analogous. Never mind, you get it. It's time to move on from Trump. Suffice it to say, you're not going to just tell people what to do. Democrats don't tell people what to do. We don't listen to Democrats when they tell us what to do. And if there's a Republican in this audience who thinks you're just going to order your friends and relatives who are Trump supporters to just stop it and go with someone else, quit being a jackass. That's not going to happen. Just stop trying. Stop saying it. Stop with the phrase, we have to move on from. You're not going to make Trump voters move on from Trump. I don't know how many times I'm going to have to say that, but there are people who still need to hear it. Don't bother going to battle with your Republican relatives over Thanksgiving saying, we got to move on from Trump. Don't bother. You're not going to convince them. Save your breath. So again, I say, who's the man or woman, save Ron DeSantis perhaps, who's going to step into the breach and take him on and beat him? And I'm still not confident Ron DeSantis could do it, to be perfectly honest with you. That's not a knock on Ron DeSantis. It has nothing to do. It's not an editorial comment against anyone. It speaks to the real and present strength of Donald Trump's voters, whether you like that or not. It is real and it hasn't left. And you can't win without them. So that is something that people are going to have to deal with, whether they like it or not. And so all these Republican Party types, you know, Bill Barr and Paul Ryan and Chris Christie and maybe some of you in this audience, it's time to move on. You're not moving on without Trump voters. You're not doing it. You can't. You can't. Listen to me. You can't win without Trump voters. Get that through your head. So ordering them to just stop liking Trump is not a strategy. Okay. Andy's in Boyertown to get us started. Andy, I'm glad you called. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. I live in Berks County, and I was really concerned about, you know, the Republican turnout, and I did some investigating into the precincts in Boyertown, in the Berks County region. And in fact, Republicans' turnout was much higher. Well, not much higher, about 2.5% higher than Democrats. And that's including Democrat mail-in voting. And so I think Republicans have a great way of improving their overall turnout by getting those Republicans that didn't show up at the polls to do some mail-in balloting. So,
how did it go in Berks? What was the final breakdown in terms of who won the county? Do you know?
I'm pretty sure Oz and Mastriano actually won. The in-person voting for Democrats was like 68%, and Republicans were 92% in-person voting.
Yeah.
So obviously the mail-in voting is heavy on the Democrat side. But overall, and actually Democrats have a larger total registration in the county as well. So the Republicans did well. I mean, I don't know relative to other elections or in other counties. But in Berks County, they did well. And what's really surprising, which really surprised me, is that the Redding City area had actually the lowest Democratic turnout. The Republicans, even though they have very small numbers in the city registered, they actually turned out much higher than the Democrats. So I think the Republicans.
So what do you learn here? What are you saying you've ultimately concluded here about the presidential election of 2024 based on what you've just shared?
I think the Republicans should still go out to the polls. But if you're a county, you know, somebody's ahead of the Republicans, is to go look for those Republicans that didn't show up at the polls, get a mail-in ballot to them. And I think you can get at least 3 or 4% more Republicans voting. And that probably will tip, at least in our county, go Republican.
Andy, thank you. I think that's a very astute summary. I appreciate your call. 610-850-0990, the number, 610-850-0990. Let's go to Karen in Langhorne. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. How are you today? Happy Thanksgiving week.
Blessed and highly favored. Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving. Amen. So I've been reaching out to the Republican Party in my area. When they call to ask me to work the polls, I always give them this huge speech about what are you doing to reach out to the black vote? Because the very large portion of the black vote is very conservative. It feels left adrift by the Democrat Party. It's pro-life. It's pro-capitalism. It's pro-small business. The values that I'm not going to say Republicans have, because I'm far beyond that at this point, but that conservatives have. And, you know, generally I get, oh, that's a great idea. Why don't you reach out to our headquarters? So I did. So I called the headquarters, and after the person listened to me and countered a couple of things that I had to say, they go, well, I understand this is important to you, so why don't you, you know, come up and talk to us. And I went, important to me? I know where my vote goes. It should be important to you, because these are votes you're leaving on the table at a time when a large part of the public is looking for a home because they know they don't belong in the Democrat Party. But thank you.
Karen, do you think
it's important to me?
Yeah. Would it behoove Republicans, do you think, specifically black voters, would it behoove them to start finding folks of color to go into their own neighborhoods and start canvassing and collecting ballots? As Democrat, would that work? Is that a workable strategy? Basically sending black conservatives or Republicans into black neighborhoods. Maybe that's cynical, but I mean, is that the play? I don't know.
Not until the candidates are going into the neighborhoods. Not until the message is in the neighborhood about values-based voting. I mean, to show up to ask for your ballot when you haven't shown up to ask for your heart and mind is a losing proposition. They already have that. It's called the Democrat Party. I have a girlfriend who lives in a black community where when she walks up to the poll, they go, you know you're supposed to vote Democrat. And then when she walks out, they say, did you vote Democrat? And then they send someone to your house and said, we're coming just to verify that you did vote Democrat. It's one of those Philadelphia precincts that's never had a Republican vote because they change it.
Mm.
You know, so... Wow. Yeah, but you have to take the message in before you walk in and say, give it to me, if you're not willing to go in. I mean, it's great. Oz went to Kensington, but, you know, Kensington is not, I mean, the white drug addicts have basically taken over Kensington, so mazel tov.
It's interesting that Michael Torres said that the crime message may play in Philadelphia, but it really, in terms of suburbs, still isn't really a thing. And that maybe that's not the message. I don't know if the crime message flips Philadelphia Democrat voters to Republican for Oz. But Karen, I appreciate the call. It's an interesting discussion. I mean, the debate about Republicans trying to get the black vote has been going on for decades. How do you get it? How do you go in and talk? You know, Trump famously said, "What do you got to lose?" But we know, I mean, they were concerned. They were concerned that black voter turnout was going to be low. They were really trying to hype up black voter turnout. Remember the Reverend Al came into Philadelphia just before the election. Tell them, you got to go out there and vote and end racism, vote. You know, they were trying to whip up the racism charge again because they were concerned that they didn't have enough black voter turnout or participation. And understandably so, because the city has degraded to such a degree Maybe they won't vote Republican, but they're dispirited enough they don't see any reason to turn out at all. Let's go to Linda in the Northeast. Linda, I'm glad you called. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Hi. Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. How are you today?
Okay. I just had some observations and just I got the tail end of Mr. Torres' speech, and there were a couple things that struck me. First, I do agree that, you know, it's not Trump's fault for some of the things that happened. And I do believe that the Republicans are like eating their young, so to speak, and need to take Trump's message, which has to do with appealing to the emotions. I think the one thing that the Democrats, and I'm full disclosure, I'm a Democrat. I voted for Trump twice, and I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm more like the old-fashioned blue dog kind, you know,
sure,
of Democrat.
Sure.
So
the sane ones.
Anyway, what's that?
The sane ones.
Yeah, the sane ones. So, you know, what Trump did was appeal to the emotion, and the sense of people's self-determination and independence, and the fear that would go away if there was a liberal Democrat in Congress as president. And unfortunately, the Democrats do basically what Trump did, and made it a very emotional thing. As soon as you instill fear, you know, like, even if, like, Josh Shapiro, all he had to do was to be reasonable and not scary or not evil or not extreme. And it would have been better if we would have people who really have the values, compassion and caring for everyone, would have done something like with Fetterman, for example. How could he be running? He should be taking care of himself. Where's the compassion of the Democratic Party to not say, hey, step down. You have to take care of yourself, for example.
Linda, may I ask you a question? And this is personal, but I'm just curious. And it's fine if you did. If you say yes, that's fine. Did you vote for Josh Shapiro?
Yes, I did. But my reasons are different. Okay. I'll also give you another disclosure. I'm a religious Jew. Okay. And I know something about Josh Shapiro's upbringing that may make him, and, you know, and I sent my kids to a religious day school, and they're all adults now. So, and I know something about the background of Josh Shapiro that might make him on certain things reasonable, especially when it comes to people having choice with regard to school. That's all I'll say about that. It's a very personal
reason why I voted
for him.
Understood. So let me ask you the other. Did you vote for Fetterman? I can't imagine you did.
No. I voted for Oz.
Yeah.
I voted for Oz. The other thing I do have to be honest, and then this also, again, what has to do with how things were presented for some people about Mastriano. Mastriano didn't clearly deal with how he was portrayed as being scary, taking away people's rights. Even to be honest, the issue about his ties to anti-Semitism, that really, he didn't do a good job. And I think, to be honest, at least as far as the Jewish vote, that may have taken away from that. So, again, it brings it back to the emotional piece. I think it's correct that a party needs to be more unified, but they need to understand that, you know, your opponent is fighting like an apple, and you got to match an apple, not be a banana with that.
Good stuff, Linda. I appreciate your call. Trump addressed over the weekend the fact that abortion was clearly the thing. Above all else, the abortion thing. Highly emotional. Yes, it was very emotional. I mean, she's exactly right. I don't disagree with a thing. Democrats ran on ooga booga, and we're in a climate where that works. somehow what the Democrats have done to the country is less scary to a great deal of people than what Democrats claim Republicans are about to do to you. Follow me? Democrats have made this country, to me, a very scary place to live, and yet there are millions of people convinced that what Republicans are about to do is scarier. American Music Awards were last night. Lionel Richie won like the greatest old-timer of ever history music, whatever. I don't know what those were. Whenever you get old, they hand you an award, I guess, for being old, being around a long time. Is that basically the thrust of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he won something about being old yesterday in the music business. So congratulations to Lionel Richie for staying alive and being around and being old. I remember him, actually, from my youth. I remember my mother listening to him when vinyl was still a thing. I remember the album cover, as a matter of fact. Taylor Swift won a bunch of awards, too. She spent all weekend trashing Ticketmaster. So, like the Republicans trash Trump.
AM 990, the end.
WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. 3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.